Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
October 14th, 2011, the Norris Group returned with its award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. An expert lineup of industry specialists joined Bruce Norris to discuss current industry regulation, head-scratching legislation, and the opportunities emerging for savvy real estate professionals. 100% of the proceeds support the Orange County affiliate of Susan G. Komen for The Cure. This event would not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Foreclosure Radar and Sean O'Toole, Housing Wire, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, and President Bill Tan. Investors Workshops with President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronsgeist. Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander. San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry. Real Wealth Networks, Fry Wiles, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. The event video can be found on isurvived2011.com.
I hadn't intended to ask this question, but an $8,000 rebate, basically, was equivalent to a nothing down loan most of the time on those prices. How did that loan portfolio perform? Do we know?
No, we don't. We have not isolated those particular loans.
That might be interesting because that's in essence a nothing down program, only without spending the $8,000.
Well, yeah, and I'm pointed out to some of the bankers who had made loans under that program and held them in portfolio that the loan to value ratio they believed they had at the time they made the loan actually was higher after prices receded again, so they actually had more risk in their portfolio than they thought they did.
And I still think it'll come out very well.
I think it will, because we're close to the bottom.
Yeah, but you also probably created a payment that was less than rent.
Absolutely.
So,
full disclosure, I bought a house in Florida in last September. They were on sale.
Yeah, that's it. Eric, you wrote a book, The Post-Catastrophe Economy, and this is one of the many parts I've underlined in the book, the most underlined book I've ever read, actually. The United States will rebuild on its ethics of hard work, education, fairness, and honesty, its culture of entrepreneurial versus financial risk-taking, of competition, of savings, and of avoidance of debts, its core competencies in technology development and original invention, and its strong institution of property rights and rule of law. And I think it was your hope that we would have spent the last 2 years going forward and hopefully building infrastructure to a new set of tools, transportation, energy, communication, and infrastructure that you call, I don't know what you call it, TC?
Techie economy.
Techie, okay.
Not how very catchy, but...
How are we doing?
I would say that we did not do that.
We did not do that.
I would characterize the policy that we took instead as print and pray.
Print and pray? I knew we were going to have one of them on the panel. All right. Print and pray.
So there was no concerted effort or no consensus on what to do beyond the emergency measures that were taken to halt the deflationary process and the recession.
And I think that's why I asked the question about fiscal policy, is that a long-term fiscal policy would not be short-term relief or pleasing. Is that possible? In other words, if we really did something long-term, the results would be out there a ways.
Well, if we approached it as a return on investment idea, that there's certain infrastructure that if you invest in it in a country, it increases your capacity for economic growth. And it's not an expense, not entirely, but there's a multiplier factor.
Okay.
But you have to think very carefully about how you do that. And it takes some planning, and it takes some execution. And in order to pull that off, you have to have enough of a consensus within government to not get into a dysfunctional argument about whether it's going to result in the short term in an increase in deficits.
Do we have the capacity to make that kind of come to that conclusion?
Well, I think that, as Doug was mentioning, the American public was pretty aghast at the quality of the debate that was going on about the debt ceiling. It was not a particularly constructive discussion, and I think most Americans are very frustrated by that.
I hadn't intended to ask this exactly, but there's a document that basically has a joint effort from Republicans and Democrats regarding the budget deficit and reducing it. And I'm just wondering, you know, you've got a few people from each side pour their hearts into probably a year or two's worth of work, come to a pretty legitimate conclusion. How have each of those parties reacted to that document? Did they put their arm around them with, oh, you know, it's not everything we wanted, but we know we all have to sacrifice? Or are they getting the stuffings kicked out of them from both sides? I'm just curious if anybody knows.
Well, I think that all these discussions are now so ideologically charged, it's very difficult to put anything forward. It's a simple constructive plan based on making just a simple factual argument, right, behind it. You very quickly get a dialogue that devolves into some argument about whether we're going to go bankrupt tomorrow, you know, which is just, you know, not what's going to happen.
I agree. I think the roots are there for a good discussion. If you if you take Paul Ryan's plan and the president's deficit commission plan, the two of those elements together could lead to a very constructive debate about how to make some long-term adjustments to. To your point, you're not going to fix it in 2 years. It's something that's going to take some time. But Washington just didn't engage with those as perhaps starting reference points.
Eric, you mentioned in the book something called an output gap.
Yes.
Can you tell us what that is, and are we experiencing that, and what's the end result of that?
The concept of an output gap is the Congressional Budget Office every year puts out what they project is what the growth rate of the economy would be if everybody who wanted to have a job had a job. All the producers and consumers are acting efficient as efficient actors in the market. And what happens is in a recession, so if you have a curve like this, it's the output normal growth rate. You have a recession, you have you're operating below that theoretical growth rate, and the difference is an output gap.
Okay.
And what it really means is that the real meaning of it is that it really is a measure of unemployment.
Okay.
Because and when in the 1970s, the policy was to try to close the output gap by any means necessary, which is the wrong approach. We would wind up with a lot of inflation.
If you don't close the output gap, what ends up happening?
Well, the challenge is that the usual reflation measures, monetary policy and fiscal policy for the last 30 years has been very effective at closing output gaps quickly after recessions. The problem is if we don't close it before the next recession, then we have what I call a mid-gap recession, which is another recession that opens the gap further that was left over from the previous recession. And we haven't had that since 1938.
Okay.
And that creates really significant add-on problems.
You see the likelihood of us having that?
I think it's feasible, but as Doug said, it would probably be caused by an external event, probably in Europe.
Okay. You've mentioned the next 10 years of investing will not be like the last 10. So,
thank God. So, well, we created a portfolio in 2001 of composed of treasury bonds and gold, which outperformed everything if you didn't do anything with it, which is a pretty dismal fact, right? It beat the S&P both in terms of volatility, drawdown, batting average, everything you can think of. That's not good. So hopefully over the next 10 years we get back on track where we're growing the economy by growing our corporations, by growing the economy in a more organic fashion, not through finance.
Okay. One of your investments happens to be connected to apartments. So does real estate, in your opinion, do well in the environment that we're going to find ourselves in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, the particular investment is in a company that sells into segment of B markets of residential real estate, multifamily residential real estate. And the theory behind it was that the cost of capital was going to remain low, but the rents were going to start to rise. And so cap rates are going to improve, and these are going to be profitable investments.
Okay.
So I think that's going to continue.
Last question for you. You talk about in the book that you wrote the concept of having public-private partnerships create this infrastructure. So when did we last do that successfully, and what type of infrastructure are you talking about that you think we need to do?
Well, we actually have not done that much in this country. It was very much more popular. Well, very in the early days, a lot of our highways were built with European money funding private enterprises to build our highways. And most people forget that. But we took the public route after World War II, and our infrastructure was largely built through public finance. But in Europe, the way they didn't have any money, they used, after the war, they used public-private partnerships for the most part to build their infrastructure, roads, highways, bridges, and so forth. Typically, that model is adopted in periods of time when governments are very constrained fiscally, and it becomes more efficient to combine private enterprise, market discipline of private enterprise, and the risk management of government to combine together to build infrastructure.
Okay. There was a $500 million loan, that's why I'm asking you if that was kind of an attempt to do that with Solyndra. Was that a partnership type of arrangement? I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying that can happen sometimes.
Well, one of the things I warn about in my book is that there's right ways and wrong ways to do public partnerships. The wrong way is basically getting public money and giving it to your buddies to go build things. That's kind of how they did it in the UK. You know? The right way to do it is to create a real competitive market where the partnerships actually have to compete with each other and perform to metrics, and they can't get another job unless the last one worked that well.
You know, one of the hardest things is that there seems to be a lack of credibility, to say the least, when you want to tax people more or you want to have partnerships and then you find out that the basis for that partnership was other than for a good reason. You get very suspicious about someone writing the next check or asking you to contribute more. And I don't know how we get away from that. I mean, I just don't know. That's not a question, but it's a frustration.
I don't think it's any secret that most Americans are pretty frustrated with American campaign finance. And that's one of the first things we have to fix in this country.
Okay. Sean, you going to cause trouble tonight?
I thought maybe I was supposed to sit back down after introducing Eric, given that it's the economist.
No, you did good by there. Okay. In the past, there were common reasons for foreclosures. So what are the common reasons for foreclosures? And you have them in every cycle.
Yeah, so I started investing in foreclosures in 2002. And one of the things that I had the hardest time with is that none of them made any sense. Everything had equity. All of these folks could sell. And I really struggled with this, especially as a son of a logic professor. And
did you ever want to? You ever interview the people and go, "Why are you letting this happen?"
Yeah, and so we finally, it finally dawned on me, and my partner helped me, kind of figure this out. But it was the five D's, drugs, death, disease, divorce, and denial. And when you knocked on those doors, it was one of those five things. And again, this is 02 to 06. There's equity everywhere. And, but those were the five things. And that's what I call the base rate of foreclosure. And that'll always be there.
Yeah, if you had them in 02 and 06, you're going to have them every time.
Right. It was every single time. It wasn't job loss because you could sell your house. It wasn't negative equity. It just didn't exist. So
this cycle, beyond 2006 to where we are now, what has been the added nitroglycerin that we have?
Well, I mean, your average property in California right now is $150,000 upside down by the time it hits foreclosure. So it sold for $400,000, it's now worth $250,000. It's really an insurmountable debt. And if you look at the cost of repaying that debt over 30 years, it's really not practical or smart for anyone to consider trying to pay it. And I know there's moral issues around that, whatever a lot of people have, but I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, what if we, let's try and solve it. So what would you do other than give everybody instruction booklet to say, walk away? There was just an article. I'm constantly reading. So there was just an article about Fannie and Freddie not wanting to do principal reductions. Okay. And to me, that makes sense because you've got ramifications to that, you know, that are negative. What about giving somebody a principal-only payment until they break even with an appraisal? Does that make sense? I mean, I think you'd have people make that payment.
Does that happen in the life of the loan?
Well,
you're $150,000 upside down?
Well, I'm asking, if you have, you know, we have a lot of people that are not current, but you have more people that are current in that situation. And I don't want to reward the group that's not made a payment for 2 years and get in an article saying this is wonderful. But the people that are making the payment, I think there might be an eventuality where it gets to them too, especially if the people that aren't making the payment get the goodies. But what if you just said willingly, for whatever it takes, 5% a year, you're going to pay principal down. So 25% in 5 years, you're back to square. I think you'd have a lot of people sign up for that. But I don't know if that's an acceptable suggestion to lenders. Since you're the only lender, Doug.
I think that there's lots of things that are going to be explored, including principal write-down. I think there's a lot of momentum building in Washington toward that in particular. The difficulty has always been in the foreclosure space, and yes, there's a run rate of maybe $1 million, $1.5 million might be the typical run rate given the level of homeownership and the number of households there are. But the solutions have typically been one-on-one treatments. And the mortgage servicing business, when I was at the Mortgage Bankers Association, and they still do this study there, took apart the servicing operation, and there's about 17 elements to it, and 14 of those have very clear economies of scale. Three of them have diseconomies of scale. Not just no economies, but they're actually more expensive as they get larger.
Okay.
One of those is taxes and insurance. So everybody outsources that because of all the local knowledge that you need about the jurisdictions. And the other two are default and foreclosure. So we wondered, were the diseconomies of scale sufficient to override all the other efficiencies in the servicing business? And now that experiment's been run, and we know that they are. The problem in solving it is that, and the reason that those diseconomies exist, is that the treatments are a one-on-one kind of treatment. And you have to have quite a bit of experience mm-hmm. in understanding the household's situation to determine whether or not you've got all the information, whether they fully understand the obligation, whether they're telling you about their willingness to pay, all of the resources that they have available to pay, their other commitments. So it's an intensive sort of one-on-one thing. I'd suggest that a program like that is something you would sit down and you would find some households that would be very effective under that kind of household, because you can determine they are willing to meet the commitment over a period of time, they have the resources that are available, and that they're willing to have all of that documented and make a commitment to that kind of program. There are others who you probably could put in that program that would not succeed because they don't have those criteria. The difficulty is in putting a broad-based policy, or you know, applying it to everyone, is where you find the adverse selection kinds of problems.
How are you going to accomplish principal reduction without?
We're not proposing that.
Okay,
we're asking that same question.
That's right.
Because you have a bigger problem. Not only will you be not selecting some, you will also be not selecting completely the people that are current.
Well, the worst thing is I have to deal with my mother. When TARP was voted down the first time, she called me and she said, "Douglas," which means I'm in trouble.
Okay.
What are you doing with our money? We paid our mortgage. So when you do debt forgiveness, there's a whole bunch of people who have met all their obligations, and there are going to be losses, and while they weren't involved in the transaction, on the tax side of things, they're going to be involved in repairing the losses.
Right. For those of us that own free and clear houses, can we just get a check?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
That seems fair.
Problems?
Yes, John.
You know, so I think that this idea that the foreclosure process is tough from a servicing standpoint is a self-inflicted wound. In California, I think there's actually a brilliant piece of policy here, which is that on a purchase money mortgage, right, there's no recourse. And I think this creates a really fair balance that resolves this issue and makes it very quick and easy to deal with somebody who's not paying.
That's why it only takes 600 days to foreclose in California.
It used to take 150.
Exactly.
Right? And 150 days, right, is a lot of time to give somebody to try to work through their problems, sell the property, whatever they can do. And if they can't, they lose the home. And, you know, and I think that's okay. And given that it's no recourse, I mean, compare it to the most of the rest of the world, where you have significant, you know, recourse. It can pass on to your children, right, the recourse. And here, you can walk away from the loan. And I also think it's a fair balance of risk with the lender, because the lender should take that loss. And I don't think it's fair to let that person stay in that house. They were part, you know, they made a bad decision by buying that house at that price. They had plenty of folks giving them bad advice, you know, a lot in the federal government. But they were part of it. They should lose their house, right? And the bank should take their loss.
I knew he wouldn't disappoint me.
And we should move forward. And it's not that, it's not that tough.
Yeah.
And I do think that the losses that we're trying to prevent are multiplying. And you also are creating a whole group of people that feel very entitled to still stay there. When we buy foreclosures, as you know, we meet people at the door who may not have made a payment for 2 years, and the first sentence out of their mouth is, cash for keys. I mean, that's the expectation.
And every policy coming out of Washington is increasing that expectation that they should get to live in a home for free for the rest of their lives. Imagine when the government now owns all the rentals. I mean, you want to talk about rent control problems and having no future for real estate, that's the proposal that will kill real estate in the United States forever.
Well, one of the reasons why... And to be honest with you, I don't want hedge funds to own them for the same reason, is because it's uncertainty. If some gigantic company owns 10,000 rentals, I really don't know what to do with mine, because I don't know if the playing field is legit. I don't know if they're going to put 10,000 houses for sale, but as a builder, I certainly wouldn't carve up dirt waiting, because that risk is out there that they could be my competitor at a drop of a hat. So I honestly, that's one of the reasons I'm hoping, and that's why we met, you know, trying to say, give investors a shot at taking this inventory down, because it's manageable if we don't put it on the market. If we pull it off, it is manageable, yes.
So let me pose the answer to you as a question. And first I'll give you a little bit of background. So I come out of the venture capital industry, and a lot of folks in my industry put a lot of money into a lot of bad companies back in the late 90s, and then there was a crash, and they lost their money. So they took a big haircut, so they took write-downs, and of course it was equity, not debt-based. But the principle was pretty simple. They made bad investments and lost their money.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com. The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate 2011. Adrenaline Athletics, Caldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Conaway & Conaway, Del May Properties, Elite Auctions, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Kukan and Clark Partners LLC, Las Brisas Escrow, Lievis Associates, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Pacific Sunrise Mortgage, Personal Real Estate Magazine,
Raven Paul & Company, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Board of Realtors, Stars Photography, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, Tri-Emerald Financial Group, and Weston South Coast Plaza. Visit iSurvive2011.com for more details.